The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's all sorts of ways in which the Shadow Brokers release has worked very much to the advantage of Russian interests and to the disadvantage of US interests. So, for instance, it's created a big storm, a big reminder to people about the vulnerabilities equities process. There's been a lot of concern over whether or not the US should be using exploits. It's obviously degraded US capability in the short term, because these capabilities are now essentially patched, which makes it very difficult for the National Security Agency to be using these vulnerabilities. So there's a direct loss of capability. These events have hurt the US at points of interest between US-Russian relations.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 8th, 2017. You may know him as @PwnAllTheThings, you may know him as Matt Tate, or you may know him as the author of that long Lawfare article last Friday that's been burning up the internet ever since. Matt Tate joined me this week to talk about, well, sorry to disappoint you all, not the effort by Peter Smith to recruit him to Smith's efforts to recover Clinton's stolen emails and perhaps collude with the Russians in doing so, but NotPetya and WannaCry, the two ransomware events that have followed the Shadow Brokers' release of NSA exploits. It's a really interesting conversation, if one that may frustrate you. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 237. Matt Tate on recent events in cybersecurity. All right, let's start at the beginning. This is not the first ransomware attack that we've seen using tools from shadow brokers. So let's go back a few weeks and start with WannaCry. For those listeners who are who know the subject well, it's maybe a bit of a review, but start at the beginning of the story. What happened with, what are these spate of ransomware attacks that we've seen, and where is it coming from?
Okay, so I think to really understand it, you have to rewind even a little bit further back from there. You have to go back to March, when there was this release by this hacking group called, calling themselves Shadow Brokers. And they released a bunch of vulnerabilities, one of which was this vulnerability that has been called Eternal Blue. And this is a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows that allows someone to essentially take control of a Windows computer remotely and install code on it. And the suggestion is that this came from the National Security Agency, and the NSA was using this to spy on people. But the vulnerability in question, of course, you can install any code that you want. And a couple of weeks ago, there was this attack called WannaCry, where people were using this particular vulnerability to install ransomware on people's computers in the event that they hadn't installed the fix for this particular vulnerability. And the fix for this vulnerability actually came out a couple of weeks before Shadow Brokers released it. But of course, lots of companies, for one reason or another, haven't patched their systems particularly promptly. And consequently, hackers took this Shadow Brokers release, coupled it with some ransomware, and started widely deploying it. And this was known as the WannaCry attack, where this attack was, you know, essentially global, all the computers that were connected to the internet, which is lots of corporate computers rather than people's home computers. If they were connected to the internet, they weren't filtering this particular protocol, and they hadn't installed their Windows updates from a couple of weeks earlier, then they would suddenly end up with ransomware, and all of their files would end up being encrypted.
Okay, so let's unpack a little bit of that. You say that the exploit in question is believed to have been an NSA exploit, and you mentioned this group Shadow Brokers. So let's break both of those points down. What do we know about who Shadow Brokers is, and why do people believe that these are NSA exploits?
Okay, so this was this group calling themselves Shadow Brokers. They're an anonymous internet group. They appeared in, I think it was late August last year, during the height of US-Russian tensions. So lots of people have attributed them to being Russian. The US government hasn't put an official stamp on that attribution. This group appeared. They claimed that they had a bunch of exploits that they had stolen from the National Security Agency, and they started releasing some of them. Initially, lots of these vulnerabilities were relating to things like routers and so on. And then, of course, in March, they released a bunch of Windows vulnerabilities, one of which was this particular one, which Microsoft calls the excitingly named MS-1710, because it's the 10th vulnerability that they patched in 2017. And essentially, in the dump that they released, this was called Eternal Blue, which is where it's got this name from.
And how confident should we be that these really are NSA exploits as opposed to somebody else's or something that whoever these Shadow Brokers people are, they may have produced themselves?
So the vulnerabilities in question, they're highly engineered exploits. They're using all sorts of things which I think The Intercept last year, they were able to correlate to some of the Snowden documents. I think there's good reasons to believe that this, you know, either is in its entirety NSA exploits or has been mixed with NSA exploits that they've been able to steal. And bear in mind that last year as well, there was this guy, Hal Martin, who was arrested for alleged thefts of information from the National Security Agency, which happened very shortly afterwards. And there's been a bunch of media leaks by administration officials suggesting that, yes, they're the same.
So you're pretty confident that this is genuinely stolen NSA material?
I think there's very little doubt based on public information at the moment.
And how confident are we that Shadow Brokers is the Russians, as opposed to some kind of anonymous-like group or some other state actor?
So this is a little bit harder because, of course, there's less information about them. They've appeared completely anonymously. They intentionally use language that's very highly obfuscated. I think that there's good reasons to think that that's completely deliberate to thwart any attempt at linguistic analysis. They've appeared at lots of times that have been very convenient for sort of US-Russian geopolitical events. So, for instance, in January, I think it was, the US ratcheted up in Syria, and then Shadow Brokers suddenly appeared condemning this. So I think there's lots of good reasons to think that they're very likely to be Russian. Also, when you bear in mind who are the number of countries that would have access to these types of tools to be able to defend themselves from the long arm of US law enforcement and would be willing to use this kind of capability in this kind of way? It really, there's not many other people that it could be when you sort of work through who the different actors could possibly be.
If I were the Russians and I had stolen a large cache of NSA exploits, I would be relatively loath to blow them all by releasing them either publicly, the way shadow brokers did the first batch of them, or by loosing them in the wild in a fashion that seems relatively indiscriminate, like the WannaCry release. I would want to either hang on to them to use them myself, or to release them in a fashion that was, you know, particularly damaging to some in support of some strategic objective. So how do you understand what WannaCry was, assuming that these are A, genuine stolen NSA exploits, and B, that Shadow Brokers is, you know, a Russian intelligence operation of some sort? How do you understand what the purpose was here, what the goal is here?
Right. So I think, first of all, the most important thing is to recognize that the WannaCry event, although it used this vulnerability released by Shadow Brokers, was not necessarily by the same group as Shadow Brokers. So it's quite possible that, supposing the Shadow Brokers group is Russian intelligence, that they released this vulnerability in order to achieve one particular objective, and then WannaCry was using, or the people behind WannaCry were using this vulnerability for their own objective, and perhaps Russian intelligence didn't foresee that this was going to occur. But I think that there's all sorts of ways in which this has, certainly the Shadow Brokers release has sort of worked very much to the advantage of Russian interests and to the disadvantage of US interests. So for instance, it's created a big storm, a big reminder to people about the vulnerabilities equities process. There's been a lot of concern over whether or not the US should be using exploits. It's obviously degraded US capability in the short term because these capabilities are now essentially patched. There's lots of antivirus companies which will watch for these particular exploits being used, which makes it very difficult for the National Security Agency to be using these vulnerabilities. So there's a direct loss of capability. And from the Russian perspective, this also it sort of feeds into their geopolitical interests because they've been these events have hurt the US at points of interest between US-Russian relations.
So you think that the WannaCry release was simply an effort to force patching of a very large number of computers that NSA otherwise has a way into? Or was there some more specific strategic objective that this also that also has this happy collateral benefit?
So it certainly wasn't just in order to cause that direct collateral damage to the US, because the Shadow Brokers group clearly must have had these exploits for some period of time before they released them, which means that it can't have merely been to damage the US, because if that was the case, they could have released them much earlier. And they also didn't need to couple it with this sort of anonymous operation and, you know, all the rest of it. They could have just, you know, posted it to Microsoft or something, and the vulnerabilities would have become patched very quickly. So they're clearly tying this to some wider scheme. And of course, this provides them an enormous bullhorn in order to, discuss topics of interest to them. It's also provided them with an opportunity to signal to the US, hey, we've got some information from the National Security Agency. Maybe you want to be a little bit more careful about your signaling towards us. And also one of the things that I found very interesting is they've been very, very careful with lots of the messages that they've released, with lots of their statements, and even with their releases, to be very clear, to be very sort of obscure as to how much information they actually have. They've gone to a lot of effort to say, we've got more, but we're not going to tell you how much more or what else is there.
One of the major countries affected by WannaCry, in terms of the number of computers that were locked up as a result of it, appears to have been Russia. And so I'm wondering, was this a screw-up on their part, or was it really a don't-care kind of thing? The larger geopolitical message of the release is more important than any specific damage that it may do.
So it's not immediately clear to me that when they released this vulnerability that they knew that it would become this global ransomware event. I think they perhaps should have known, and that they should have been much more cautious about the release that they did. But it's not... There's ways in which they could have released this without realizing that it would be immediately coupled into a global ransomware worm. And it's also important to remember that these are different events. That there was one group that released the vulnerability, and there was a different group that coupled that vulnerability with this ransomware and released that onto the world. And we have to be quite careful to make sure that we don't mix those two events, because they might be different people and they might have different motives behind it.
And do we know anything about the second group? So Shadow Brokers releases the vulnerability and then some other group makes this ransomware event. Do we have any sense of who that was or what their motivations were?
So we do again. There's not a ton of information about it because, you know, this was released, sort of on the world in a way that didn't leave a lot of fingerprints. But we can look at the malware that's in use, and we can compare it with other malware that we've seen before, and we can tie it to other operations that we've seen before. And there's a lot of technical similarities between the ransomware component of the WannaCry attack and a particular piece of ransomware designed by a different hacking group called Lazarus Group, which is affiliated with North Korea, which is sort of a very unusual hacking group in that they do a lot of... they were responsible, for instance, for the attack on Sony. They were responsible for lots and lots of attacks in South Korea. They were responsible for the attack on Bangladesh Central Bank. So we know a bunch of stuff about this group, and we're able to tie them, but not particularly strongly. You know, strong enough that it's noteworthy, but not strong enough that it's a slam dunk case.
All right, so that brings us then to last week, when a second ransomware event takes place. So bring us up to speed on that.
Right, so last week there was a completely different ransomware event. Initially, a bunch of researchers said there's a lot of technical similarities between this new ransomware and an old piece of ransomware that they called Petya. They, a couple of hours later, realized that this was a bad correlation, and they changed their name to not Petya in order to make the point that they're not the same, which is how this new name came about. Basically, this new piece of ransomware was deployed on a very large number of machines, particularly affecting Ukraine, basically in three stages. So in the first stage, they wanted to install the malware itself. And they did this by subverting a software update mechanism of a piece of software called MEDoc, which is accountancy software used in Ukraine. And this update installed this malware on accountants' machines in the event that they were using this particular piece of software. And then the second stage worked, which was it basically tried to move within the company to attack other machines that were within the same network, which is what we would refer to as a lateral attack within the company network. And this particular attack used this Eternal Blue exploit, but it also used a couple of other techniques, like it would search the computer that it landed on to see if there were any passwords that it could use in order to log into other computers on the machine. and it would then infect all of these other computers. And then the third stage is that it would then encrypt all of the files on those computers so that they were rendered inoperable and demand $300 worth of bitcoins in exchange for decrypting it. For various reasons, almost immediately, the email address for contacting the hackers was disabled. Lots of people did some analysis on the ransomware and concluded that this encrypting part was done really badly, and it wasn't clear that actually that could ever be decrypted at all anyway. And so there's been a lot of speculation that perhaps this ransomware component wasn't really in order to make money. I mean, because it's Bitcoin, we can even see how much money they made. They made about $10,000 from this entire attack.
And you can see that by looking at the blockchain and figuring out how much Bitcoin was sent to the public key associated with the malware.
Right. Bitcoin is one of these sort of interesting protocols in that it doesn't tie wallets to people, but it does make all of the transactions very public. So you can't work out based on a Bitcoin wallet address who owns that money, but you can see the transactions as they go in and out of that Bitcoin wallet. So since we know which Bitcoin wallet they said send $300 to this Bitcoin wallet, we can look it up and see who has sent, you know, Bitcoins, or which other wallets have sent money to this account, and how much is in there. And we can see there's about $10,000, or there was until yesterday when they withdrew it all.
Well, you may as well keep your $10,000. So what do we know about who is responsible for NotPetya? Is there any reason to think that it's the same people who the Lazarus group, who may or may not be associated with North Korea in the WannaCry? It seems like the whole operation was done a little bit less competently.
Well, it depends what the motive was. So in the event that the motive was to make money, then certainly this was not a very competent attack. They made, you know, $10,000 by producing some quite complicated software. And frankly, they could have made better money by just, you know, contracting and writing some websites for a living. So in the event that that was their motive, they clearly screwed up. But in the event that their motive wasn't to make some money, but actually was to destroy all these computers, they were monumentally successful, because actually, I think I heard 80% of companies in Ukraine are required to run this accountancy software in order to file their taxes for the Ukrainian government. And when you actually look at who was affected by this particular piece of ransomware, there was a bunch of different companies that were affected, including international firms, but the weight of damage was really quite heavily focused on Ukraine. And for this reason, a lot of people have sort of looked at this and said that there's a lot of similarities between this and Russian cybercrime ransomware. And also, this is, you know, so obviously, you know, the blast radius is Ukraine. So a lot of people have been openly speculating that this was an attack by the Russian government on Ukraine, although we haven't really got anything much more substantive than that at the moment, other than sort of the fact that there's this glaringly obvious motive to really tie that together.
Okay, so we've got a Russian group, presumably Russian group, that releases the exploits to begin with. We've got a perhaps North Korean group that, for reasons unknown, maybe just mayhem, creates a global ransomware event a few weeks ago. And then we have a circumstantially Russian group that creates a more targeted ransomware attack just against Ukraine. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind that the second one did affect companies outside of Ukraine as well, but the blast radius was primarily focused on Ukraine.
Right. And so how big is the total blast of the two events? I mean, big in Ukraine, but like what's the magnitude of the problem created by the combination of WannaCry and NotPetya?
Well, the first attack was substantially bigger, and the reason why it was so much bigger was because it, you know, basically if your computer was on the internet and it wasn't filtering this particular protocol and you hadn't patched, which is an awful lot of computers, then you would be attacked, and then they would be within your corporate network and they would attack across your entire internal infrastructure. So that was a very, very large event. The second one was much smaller, but it was much smaller almost entirely because this initial intrusion was targeting MEDOC's auto-update facility in order to intrude on all these computers in Ukraine. And I think a lot of people need to be very, very careful to sort of sit back and think how lucky we are that that was the initial intrusion vector and not one of, you know, Silicon Valley's software updaters, you know, from Dell or from Adobe or from Microsoft or from Google, you know, where their customers measure in the billions and are not just in Ukraine. So I think in many respects, we really dodged a bullet with this second attack.
So how generalizable is the methodology here of attack? Could you do this with one of the major software companies, or is this a creature of the fact that you know, this particular Ukrainian software developer is, or a software vendor is, you know, not especially good, so you can go after its users relatively easily. Could you do the same thing with Microsoft or Dell or Adobe?
So the only big difference is, of course, you know, these big US technology firms understand the threat a little bit more and are much more careful to protect their updates to make sure that they're genuine before they're released. But in principle, it's the same technology behind these software updaters. Essentially, in the event that you can distribute malware and get it signed by the software update key, then software will run on all of those computers. And that's a really massive threat that we need to be very careful about. And with some of the really big US technology firms, you know, the Microsofts and Googles, they're pretty good at defending against those types of risks. I think what MEDOC really shows is that there's a bunch of these smaller companies who people haven't really heard of, who actually manage this sort of infrastructure for, or this IT infrastructure for really big, important sectors of the economy, where in the event that they're compromised, actually they can deploy malware to a very large number of computers very quickly. And if you're unlucky, that's going to be ransomware that's going to move very quickly across internal networks and do a lot of damage. And I think we need to sort of step back and enumerate which ones there are and try and limit the damage that they can cause.
So I would think this would be a particularly big issue with respect to apps, where you have these little companies that come out of nowhere and create a big app that distributes extremely widely, very quickly, and auto updates. I'm thinking about, you know, Angry Birds, right? Where we went from nobody having heard of Angry Birds to everybody having it on their phone within, you know, about an hour and a half. And I would think that would be a very I know nothing about the security of Angry Birds, but I would think that's a very dangerous pattern, given what happened with NotPetya.
So that's right. The one thing that's a little bit different there with apps is because apps were invented much more recently. Lots of these update through various massive company stores. So things like Android and Apple manage their own app stores and limit the amount of damage that an individual app can do. So in the event that Angry Birds was hacked, then they could certainly, the hackers could certainly push malware to your phone that would compromise all of the information inside the Angry Birds app, it's less easy for them to go from that to compromising your whole phone. The real problem is with lots of these much older systems, you know, where Windows in particular is a much older system. It doesn't have a sort of centralized app store in the way that iPhones and Android devices do. And lots of these companies that write, you know, little apps for Windows computers, you know, to do sort of CAD or to, you know, do accountancy or, you know, all these types of little out-of-the-way apps that run on Windows computers, lots of these do automatic updates, and they do them with full system permissions, and they're really maintained by, you know, these mom-and-pop stores who really don't know how to secure their systems to make sure that they can't be misused to push ransomware.
And is this principally a Windows problem, or is there, does the Apple environment have the same problem?
So it affects basically all laptop type computers. So I mean, Linux and Mac and Windows are the key problems, and it's because of their lack of this centralized app store. Windows is a bigger problem just because it's a much bigger platform.
Right. So what should we expect next? These exploits are out in the wild now. We've seen two in the last few weeks major events from them. How quickly will patching clean up the broad problem that their release has created, and what should we expect to see in the meantime?
Right, so I think the WannaCry event and the NotPetya event sort of provide us with quite starkly different views into the problem that we face. With the WannaCry event, what we really saw was we saw that people not installing security patches for one reason or another caused, you know, this attack to be as big as it was. But fundamentally, that was a problem that could be solved by patching. And understanding why these companies weren't patching as quickly as they should have been was really the takeaway event from the WannaCry attack. The NotPetya one is one that worries me much more, because it's not something that we can simply fix with patching. Because although the internal lateral movement used Eternal Blue as part of it, they also looked for passwords. They also moved around using standard sort of Windows authentication around internal networks. And the initial intrusion was not a zero-day vulnerability. It was misusing these software updaters by these tiny little companies that can't keep their updaters secure. And so it seems to me that this second attack is a much more worrying problem, because it's not one that we can just ask people to fix by making sure that they install their updates on time.
So what do you do about it as a an individual user, or as an individual? I mean, I suppose as an individual user, you can say, going to be really careful about which small companies I deal with, and going to deal with major vendors as much as possible, right?
So I think that's right. I think that as an individual, you have to be careful which software you're dependent on. You know, there's obviously limits as to how much you can control there. But if you don't need a particular piece of software, you might want to think about whether or not you want to rely on them being secure as well. For organizations, that's also true. But a lot of the damage with the NotPetya event was really sort of generally low sort of security hygiene within corporate networks. You know, having users with far too powerful credentials that could be used to authenticate to far too many computers across the corporate domain, which basically meant that when one user got hacked, very quickly that person's credentials were being used to propagate this malware across the company network. And that's a harder problem to solve, because that's really a sort of a cyber hygiene going away and thinking about cybersecurity for the company much more seriously, rather than just plugging in a new security product or making sure that you're patching on time. So that's a much harder problem for big companies. I think perhaps for Silicon Valley, for the technology companies, what we might start seeing is companies like Microsoft really clamping down on software auto-updaters and saying, in future, if you want to be updating your app, you're going to have to do this through some sort of centralized Windows store rather than through updaters that you've written yourself, so that we can make sure that if something goes wrong, it only damages your app, not the entire of the user's computer. And I sort of see that's the way that that's going to resolve, at least on Windows.
Matt, is there anything else you want to talk about? Anything else been going on in your cybersecurity world the past couple weeks?
There's not much else that's been going on at the moment.
All right. Well, if anything changes, we'll have you back.
Yeah, you'll be the first to know.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Peter W. Smith and his memory for greatly increasing interest in this episode on NotPetya and WannaCry. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet it, share it on Facebook, put it in Reddit subgroups. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. Leave us a rating, and thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.